Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
Shorts!
From
WNYC.
Yes.
And NPR.
All right. 3, 2, 1. Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, the podcast.
This week we are going to.
You
were going live.
Sort of.
From the New York Public Library, where they have a program called New York Public Library Live.
So let's just get the introductions done.
Steve, when was it, by the way?
When was it? It was in November.
Was it on a Monday or a Thursday or Wednesday?
I don't remember the day, but I do remember the people who are on the stage with me. They are wonderful, but irritating. They are Stephen Johnson, who's got a new book called Where Good Ideas Come From. And then there's Kevin Kelly with a book that he entitles What Technology Wants.
So that's Kevin. Wow. That's just a weird question, right? I mean, if I met a spoon, I know what it wants. It wants whatever I want. I take it, put it in the soup, bring it to my mouth, suck on it, put it down. When it's down, it's just nothing. It doesn't want anything. So at least that's my notion. So when you ask this question, or actually, you don't even ask it. Your book title answers it. What Technology Wants. What does that mean?
So I think we view technology generally to mean all this new stuff, this gadget stuff, and stuff that's in our pockets and around our household. But I wanted to look at it, not the individual objects, because as a single object doesn't want really anything, as you're suggesting. I wanted to look at the way in which that object, that iPhone requires thousands of different technologies to make that one other technology. So there is a web of technologies that are kind of interdependent, interweaving to produce what I think of as sort of a superorganism of technology. That
you mean all the spoons, all the forks, all the knives, and all the telephones?
All the telephones, all the factories, all the roads, everything together, and us together form a new thing that, like other superorganisms, have an emergent kind of agenda that is beyond just the spoon. So the spoon itself is sort of like the bee or the ant in the colony. It doesn't really mean much, but together, all those spoons and everything else connected together, all the little chips, all the wires, all the roads, it does form something that does begin, in a very small way, to have the slimmest bit of autonomy. And autonomy that wasn't there in the individual pieces.
Autonomy and some kind of will?
Well, so want. That's a strong word when I use the word want, because we immediately think of what you want and what I want and say it's deliberately thinking about, what do I want? But I mean want in the way in which that flower, when it was alive,
it's sort of hanging on.
Wanted light, and so it kind of leans towards the light a little bit. It has a drift, it has a tendency towards the light. It's not intelligent, it's not conscious, but the plant itself wants light. It leans toward the light. So the technium, which is the word I use to distinguish this whole superorganism of technology, it's leaning in certain directions. It has certain tendencies, so it wants to go in certain directions.
We'll get to the directions where it may want to go. Let me ask you, your question is a little more modest than his.
I aim a little lower.
This is Steve Johnson.
It's been my career path is to aim just a little lower than Kevin. Figure out where Kevin is going and just steer right underneath that.
So your question is where do good ideas come from? So for you, let me look at the word idea. For you to use that word, what do you mean?
Everything from, you know, scientific breakthroughs, technological breakthroughs, breakthroughs in the creative arts, and also just kind of ordinary breakthroughs in our lives where we have a good idea that helps us kind of live a little bit better, be a little bit better in our jobs, you know, human innovation.
But when you use the word innovation or idea, so for most people in the cartoon version, that's the light bulb going on. So right. Some guy is sitting there thinking, bing, and then they think, oh, E equals MC squared, yeah. Or something like that. So for you, when you look into a brain, you don't see anything coming out of nothing. There's something a little bit more.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest things I think you have to kind of undo when you approach a topic like this, which is this idea that the breakthrough idea, the light bulb moment, is a single thing happening in a single mind, and that it happens in an instant. For some reason, we want to tell the story that way. There's this kind of innate desire. I mean, as a storyteller, I want to tell the story that way, too. And people do tend to build these elaborate fictions about their kind of moments of epiphany. But when you go back and look at the historical record and kind of rewind the tape and play it slowly, and so many of these breakthrough, allegedly kind of breakthrough epiphanies, what you find is, in fact, that the idea was incubating for a very long period of time. It actually builds upon other ideas by other people. It's more of a kind of a remixing of other people's concepts and other people's tools, and it kind of fades into view over a much longer period of time. This is what I call the slow hunch in the book, that it's not this kind of gut impression or this sudden, you know, moment of clarity, but this much more evolutionary, more kind of lingering process.
Do you have the sense that there is never a eureka moment, or do you have, like, you know, one eureka moment and 50 slow, small intervals?
I think that there are moments where you do kind of advance in some clear fashion, and you suddenly do see things in a new way. A lot of them come in dreams. Actually, the book talks a lot about how many amazing empirical scientific discoveries actually occur to people in dreams. But I guess part of what I'm trying to do with this argument is to kind of correct that, the emphasis we place on those things.
And the other thing about those eureka moments is that they may, and often usually do, occur to at least 10 other people at the same time, right, which diminishes the eureka-ness of it.
Right. For example?
For example, every single invention that we know about, for example, the telephone, the patents for the telephone were submitted by Alexander Graham Bell and Gray within 3 hours of each other.
Really?
Yes. And the light bulbs were the light bulb that we associate with Thomas Edison. He was the last of 23 other people.
To mean there was no light bulb, 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 then boom!
Within a matter of a couple of years, light bulb. Everybody had the light bulb idea.
What would explain the sudden ubiquity of an idea after a long, eternal silence?
The precursor inventions that are required for that next step have all been done. So it's like a growth where you need to go through a certain stage to get to the next stage. You have to have all the parts. And because no idea is alone, the light bulb required, you know, whatever is 100 other sub-inventions to sustain it, to even conceive of it. And when they're in place, and then it's like the next idea is just there. And so being too early with an idea is really is bad or worse than being too late.
So we both use this, Kevin and I are both kind of fans of this phrase from Stuart Kaufman, this idea of the adjacent possible.
The adjacent possible.
It's just bear with me. It's useful. And the idea is
so
basically...
So many syllables.
At any given time... Oh, come on. This is a very literary crowd. They can handle the set of syllables. So the idea is at any given time, both in the evolution of life and in the evolution of technology, there are kind of, given the state of the current system, there are a finite set of moves that are possible. So imagine it like a chessboard, right? You're in the middle of a game, there's a certain number of moves that are possible, a much larger set of moves that are not possible. The same is true of you know, technological history. You cannot invent a microwave oven in 1650, just as you cannot invent an automobile in ancient Egypt.
Just to make sure, you could imagine one, right. But you can't build it.
Yes, although it is remarkably hard to imagine one. That's part of the point here. I mean, when I saw this in detail in Invention of Air, the book about your friend Joe Priestley, who I like that you're a colloquial friend in terms of him.
He killed a lot of mice. So
Priestley is most famous for inventing oxygen, isolating oxygen for the first time, which is another case of a multiple discovery where three other people kind of discovered it right around the same time independently, more or less. And the point was that they were able to think about isolating oxygen for the first time, partially because there were tools. That there were scales and things that made it easier to kind of realize that this element was there. But the biggest one was a conceptual leap, which is it only had become possible a couple of years before to even think about the air as being something you wanted to investigate scientifically. Up until that point, they were like, well, I want to investigate wood and bodies and hearts and brains and rocks, but
The stuff was pure. Why would we study that? There's nothing there, right?
You know? Right. And it was because of a number of, partially because they discovered vacuums, where they were like, not the cleaners, but the empty air, the lack of air, that they were like, okay, this is a vacuum, so there must be something in normal air that we can actually study and understand. And so conceptually, that became a platform that enabled Priestley to kind of think in a way, and his compatriots to think in a way that it was much harder to think even 5 decades before us.
Well, do you think that when the environment is ready, in some sense, then it will happen? So it's as, almost as if the technium, your phrase, is kind of whispering now.
Right. Yeah. Yes. It is. It is an environment that we're in, and it is.
It's creepy to me.
It is creepy, and it's also because it's inevitable too. That's also another creepy word that people get spooked by.
Inevitable.
Inevitable. Right.
Do you believe that? Do you believe that a spoon is an inevitable thing that's bound to happen if you're hungry and you invent soup?
Yes, definitely. So the question is I don't think everyone.
But that everyone would think of spoon at the same time.
They probably did.
Let me try this. Yeah. We're going to win you over, right?
One very active evolutionary theory debate is something like the inevitability of evolution, given enough time, evolving eyes, right? Yes. Light is the fastest way to transmit information, and so the idea is that given enough evolutionary time, creatures would evolve the ability to kind of process and make sense of light and to somehow kind of act on that information, right? Mm-hmm. And it turns out what we find when we go back is that eyes independently evolved multiple times in completely different lines because there was just something about the physics of the world that made that, despite the fact that evolution didn't, on some level, want to, there was no intelligent designer saying eyes would be good, light waves move very fast, that would be a good thing to do. But evolution kept stumbling its way towards that innovation on these separate paths. Okay. And I think that's where I 100% agree with Kevin.
No one says that eyes wanted to be there. No one said that there was a niche called the eye niche waiting for eyes.
The very serious question, which I think is real, is then how do you describe that? How do you describe that inevitability of a system not being directed, somehow ending up again and again? If you rewound the tape and ran it again, you would have eyes. Eyes would just keep showing up. So Kevin, I think, has picked this provocative but I think useful way of describing it, which is that there is this tendency of that system to go towards those attractors. There are kind of magnets that the system will gravitate towards.
Look what he's done. He's added spoons.
No, so, but spoons are the point. Eventually people will invent spoons as well. Spoons are an attractor.
So, Robert, the spoons will get together.
Why do you obsess? Why does this bother you so much?
Because, for the obvious reason that you are crossing a line here. You are saying that living systems, which have a logic, which he describes very well, have that the logic of living systems also belongs to these inanimate things.
Right.
The history of technology sounds like, from both of you, sounds suspiciously like the history of life.
Right. And I think...
I'm very suspicious of this.
You should be, because the Mac does not look like a sunflower. But there are tremendous similarities in many ways. And there was a famous evolutionary biologist, Niles Eldred, or is he still alive? And Niles's specialty is studying trilobites, mapping the morphology of them as they change. He can make kind of...
Trilobites.
Yeah. He can make trees, genealogical trees, showing them. His hobby is collecting cornets from around the world. And
cornets as in...
Exactly, trumpets. And so he uses the same techniques applied to the forms of these and actually traces out the little heritage trees. And he can show that, to a rough degree, the evolution of these technological forms resemble in many ways the kind of tracing of life as it forks and speciates. And so there is one sense in which the things that we make are really just an extension of the same evolutionary processes that made us. And that really shouldn't really be a surprise.
So, for example, here, let me show you. This is from the book. This is a picture, a graph of what happened to underwater animals in the long time ago called trilobites.
Uh-huh.
This is how they changed. And here, next to it, is a drawing showing what has happened in the history of cornet making.
So I'm seeing here two branching trees, which look kind of similar, actually.
Yeah.
So let me ask you.
I think we're selling you on this.
Yeah, well, no, but anyway, now let me get a little harder. How far are you willing to push this biology path? Kevin, it seems to me when I read your book, it seems like you almost think that ideas are kind of alive, or almost alive. You even say that if you were to look at the living systems of the world, the kingdoms of animals and plants and all those little guys, of which there are six, you then, like, in a little map, you plop this technium thing in, so you call it the seventh kingdom. Because the first six are all have mommies and daddies. I'm not sure how to explain the seventh.
Yeah, so I call it the seventh because I think it is... I place, again, the question I'm asking in a larger context is, what is the stuff that we're making and surrounding ourselves with? It is not just little bunches of gadgets. It's just not wires. We have to see that it's really part of something that's been going on for a long time. And so
there's a very big difference between a spoon and a whale. I mean,
I'm not talking about the spoon. I'm talking about the whole superorganisms of all the technology.
But it's a lot of spoons.
A lot of spoons. And what connects them is actually the fact that we have this stream of things that are organizing themselves, maintaining order, and in some cases increasing their order in the face of the rest of the universe running down. The spoons that you're obsessed with have come from that same strand. There is a strand of these galaxies and stars, and here's a little corner of the planet where this self-organizing system has been making more and more order, and it made these animals, and then more and more order and structure and complexity and diversity, and it made minds, and these minds have made another thing that has high degree of order and complexity and stuff, and may itself be starting to make other things, other minds. Does that seem scare you, spook you, worry you?
Let me read to you what let me read to you what some of your reviewers have said.
Kelly's central thesis is this: technology has its own internal logic and rhythms that are distinct and sometimes adverse to the desires of the humans that create it. Technology creates itself using humans to do its bidding. Or, humans cannot direct or prevent technology's course, at least not in the long run. Like water contained behind a dam, relentlessly seeking escape, technology will eventually find its own way.
Oh, doesn't that creep you out a little?
No,
I know. You're just you.
Seriously, it's like if you said the same thing about life, would that bother you?
No, I'm part of life. I'm just worried about the thing.
No, you're part of technology too. Don't you understand that we humans have invented ourselves? That we have this external stomach we call cooking that has changed our diets, that has changed our teeth, our jaws. We have remade ourselves. When we become literate, our brains are rewired. We think differently. We're not the same people that left Africa. We have domesticated ourselves. We are going to continue doing that. So why is that? You are technology. Does that bother you?
Well, but when you say, what does technology want, I'm not sure I'm in that sentence.
That's what creeps me out.
What would happen if, you, by your logic, and maybe as a fellow traveler by your logic, you could imagine a situation where the things that we have created, not only our ideas, but the things we have made, will have by the same processes that describe the evolution of life, will have developed a will of their own, and then there will be either a evolution at our command, or an evolution away from us, or a revolution, an evolution that might somehow compete with us. I don't know.
To some extent, aren't we already in that kind of imagined future state? I mean, you think about the internet right now. If we wanted to turn it off, it would be extremely difficult to do.
It's impossible.
Yeah, I mean, and if we did, the catastrophic, nonlinear, unpredictable effects of turning this thing off would be unbelievably devastating, right? We would have no idea what would happen. All the things that would break if the internet was off
at that point. Would we be turning off something we use, something we need? But at the moment when, I don't know where this gets this far, but at the moment when to turn off the machine is to commit a murder, that is that the machine would have come somehow sentient or full of feeling, but that would be
but
very
Kevin
morally
is very
troubling.
Clear also to defend him again. He's when you say want, and this is the danger of want, right? Because he's not talking about consciousness, he's not talking about
well, not
sentence,
yet.
Right. and it's like in the sense that you would say, you know, a little bacterium, you know, wants to kind of float up a nutrient stream or something like that, right? The bacterium presumably is not conscious of what it is doing. It's not sitting there saying, like, yummy nutrients here. This is great. If I only had a spoon, you know. It's not thinking like that, right? But nonetheless, you have to look at it and say, it is happy going up this little gradient, sucking in all these nutrients, and somehow that thing is driven towards that. And so maybe the problem is we don't quite have that I want, but there's no I.
Right.
We don't have the kind of the verb or maybe the subject.
I use want, you know, provocatively and deliberately, but partly so that we can rehearse this idea as things acquire more autonomy. Right now, the amount of autonomy in the things that we make is minuscule. It's about the size of a bacteria or a grasshopper, but it won't be. It will increase, and so we have to prepare ourselves for the fact that someday we're going to make something that will have a want. And how do we deal with that? When we make something that, you know, declares to us, oh, I am a child of God, what's our response to it? And so I use want to help us really prepare ourselves for that eventuality.
Well, let me finish with this note. You're like one of the happiest people I know. you've often said that in contemplating these future problems, you just seem to always look on the from The Life of Brian. Mm. Always look on the bright side of life. In this case, if you were to give the technium a mind of its own, is your thought that it will work out great?
Yes, I think that. What evolution moves towards is increasing sentience of all sorts. So we see that, we see throughout life, mind being invented all the time. I think what we are doing is we're kind of evolution's way to invent minds that evolution, biological evolution, could not make. So we're going to invent all kinds of ways of thinking that evolution, in a biological sense, could not reach. And the reason why we're going to do that is we're going to invent all kinds of mind, different kinds of thinking, because our mind alone is probably not sufficient to completely comprehend the universe. We need other species of thinking. So we're going to populate the universe as far as we can with other ways of thinking so that collectively we can comprehend the universe. And those other ways of thinking are ways that biological evolution probably couldn't get to itself. So I think that, yes, the more kinds of minds there are, the better.
I think part really of the problem good. Is when you're saying, are we going to be okay? Kevin is saying, absolutely, on the 10,000 year scale, we're going to be great.
And but
you're
next
saying,
year.
But what about next Tuesday?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Right. Both are valid concerns.
Some things in life are bad, they can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, that grumble, give a whistle, and this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life.
Special thanks to Paul Holdengraber, Director of Public Programs at the New York Public Library in New York City. And, of course, to Stephen Johnson, whose new book is called Where Good Ideas Come From, and Kevin Kelly, his book, What Technology Wants.
I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krilwich.
Thank you for listening.
Hello, this is Rachel Rukier, a Radiolab listener and supporter in Brooklyn, New York. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org. Thanks, guys. That just made my week.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.